Welcome to episode 336 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a grand conversation with educator, fiddle player, and our resident philosopher, Serf William. The Serf and I discuss unions and the right-wing propaganda machine, the appeal of dictatorship vis-a-vis Caesar Augustus, polls and infotainment as opposed to actual news, rock star deaths, and a few other areas of discourse as well. A grand conversation with Serf William on this week's program. We have an EW essay titled America, and our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, reads a review from the famed New Yorker magazine movie critic, film critic, Pauline Kael. And it's a review of The Godfather Part 2. We also have a poem called Bush. And all of this, as is always the case, is imbued, infused with the energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 336 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
And be creative.
America. I was watching a Little League fall ball game last night, the air crisp with the smells and dusk sunlight unique to the last few days of the summer. I love autumn. I love baseball and Little League. When it is done right, of course. And this fall ball season, I'm witnessing it done right. I have two sons on the team. One is 10 and the other is 11 years old. Their coach just recently had some sort of medical procedure done on his left cheek, leaving a scar. His team includes a couple of above-average players, mostly boys with two girls. They are certainly not a group of dominant all-stars, but, like their coaches who know the game, they are earnest, and they are having fun together, and they are improving and growing as players and as people. Last night, they came from behind in the bottom of the fifth of a six-inning game as the ball field started to become a bit dark since the rich folk who live nearby won't allow the township to put up permanent lights. But that's another story. They won because of some key at-bats, good base running, solid relief pitching, and quality fielding. But most of all, they won because of their chemistry and their heart. That, to me, is Little League baseball. And that, to me, is so wonderfully inspiring. I wish you saw them run toward each other once the first baseman caught the ball, thrown by the shortstop for the game-winning out in the top of the sixth. And I wish you heard the coach and the players out in left field after the game celebrating and reflecting on their win.
Now listen to me. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else. Something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope. Mustn't sit around and mope. Nothing's half as bad as it may appear. Wait till next year and hope. When your luck is batting zero, get your chin up off the floor. Mister, you can be a hero. You can open any door. There's nothing to it but to do it. You gotta have heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course, but keep that old horse before the cart. First, you gotta have heart.
A great slugger we haven't got.
A great pitcher we haven't got. A great ball club we haven't got.
What do we got?
We've got heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start.
Now you're getting the idea.
We've got hope. We don't sit around and mope. Not a solitary sob do we heave, mister, 'cause we've got hope.
Boys, I'm proud of you.
We're so happy that we're humming.
That's the hardy thing to do.
Ho, ho, ho. 'Cause we know our ship will come in.
So it's 10 years overdue.
Ho, ho, ho. We've got heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course, but keep that old horse before the cart.
So what the heck's the use of crying?
Why should we curse?
We gotta get better, 'cause we can't get worse.
And to add to it, we've got heart.
bogey, baby. Let's go get him.
Right, Rocky.
Now, boys, don't forget what I told you.
You betcha, Benny.
Come on, Rocky, you tell him.
We've got heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course. But keep that old horse before the car.
Who minds them pop bottles flying?
The hisses and boos.
The team has been consistent.
Yeah, we always lose.
But we're laughing cause we've got heart.
Sir Fulham, is that you?
I called you today. I'm mixing it up.
Yeah, I tried to call you. It didn't come through.
iPhones and app updates and so forth. I can't be expected to know everything.
No, you can't. And
after all, you're the one who brought up imposter syndrome.
I am a total imposter. I realize it all the time. You know? By the way, folks, this is our regular contributor, educator, fiddle player, and our resident philosopher, Surf William, on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. And yes, we have both been imposters for years, and we have witnessed each other's impostering since we're in high school.
Yes.
We're finally
indeed
coming to terms with it.
The it's a real thing. It's a real psychological thing, imposter syndrome. And, I think those of us who claim that we suffer from it, I think we're only partially telling the truth. I think there's a part of us that feels like we're awesome. But there's also a part of us that says, I can't believe I'm getting away with this. I can't believe I've pulled a fast one on everybody. And I'm actually here doing this thing. And they all think I know what I'm doing. You know, and you feel like you kind of do, but you kind of don't. Like, I always thought it would feel differently when people called me a fiddle player, or when people called me a teacher, or when people said to me, wow, you know, you speak great German. I always thought it would feel differently because I still feel like I'm fumbling through all of those things, you know, half conscious, completely inept, you know, but I'm doing it. And obviously I'm doing it because people tell me that I'm doing it.
And so where do you think that comes from, this sense of I'm not good enough, or I'm not good, or I'm a phony and all that, imposter syndrome?
My pop psychological analysis of the situation says that it's healthy to have some self-doubt. It's actually, you know, based on everything I've seen in the world around me, those who are overconfident about their way, their ideology, their technique, their belief system, those are the people who really scare me. I much prefer a little bit of doubt. Now, too much doubt can be crippling. I'm talking about healthy amounts of self-questioning. And I think it comes, honestly, I think it comes from a healthy place.
It sounds like weakness to me.
Well, right. And to a lot of people, it does sound that way. And let me tell you something. Those people, too, are suffering from imposter syndrome. It's just manifesting itself in a different way. They're super defensive. Don't joke about their competence. Don't joke about their abilities. That's too fragile an area to go to. And, you know, we know those kinds of people. Then they're not healthy.
No. And some of them are more humane and more sensitive about their existence on this planet, and others are brutal in the way that they respond to that sense of being an imposter, right? We can talk about, what's his name, the orangutan that we have in the White House, right?
All I say is the village idiot.
Right,
that's
the village idiot.
That's all I say.
And then you could talk about someone like, you know, Kurt Cobain or Chris Cornell, you know, mm-hmm. rock stars. You wanted to talk about rock star deaths. I'm sure they had that as well, and they had other issues, I suppose. I don't know. I'm not an expert, nor am I really well-read on their backgrounds. But they didn't feel like they were good enough in some way, and they took their own lives. So it can go to that extreme, too. You know, you could be brutal to other people and or be brutal to yourself.
Well, you know, I think really what you're getting at is the question of what is the healthy balance? Because when you're talking about Kurt Cobain and a lot of artists, there was certainly, you know, again, I'm not a psychologist, and I hate to misuse these terms, but I feel like there was definitely like clinical depression in there.
Yeah.
Different kinds of psychological, emotional problems that were severe that, in my opinion, probably caused them so much pain that we couldn't really appreciate that, you know, death seemed like a reasonable alternative. I don't condemn people who commit suicide. I mean, we can condemn the father of three little kids who kills himself, or, you know, a parent or a child of a parent who loves them very much. And now the parent is left to cope with the death of that child. It's a horrible thing. But I don't know what that person was going through. Like, if you're in so much pain physically or psychologically, how am I supposed to know what you can handle, how much you can take before you just want to check out? I mean, I think healthy people have thought about suicide. I've thought about it. Never had the guts to go through with it, thank goodness, but I've thought about it.
Yeah. You know, this is an uplifting conversation here in Troubadours.
I think it's completely healthy to put all this stuff out in the open. I think it's our own taboos and our own phobias and fears that stop us from just putting it all out there. I'll tell you what, and as an extension of that, the next generation coming up, our kids, right? Our kids, that generation, they're out there in the street and they're doing stuff and they're talking about it and they're gender fluid and they're advocates for the earth and they're advocates for tolerance and anti-bullying. And our generation, I know there are people in our generation, we're in our 50s, there are people who look askance at that stuff like suck it up, you know, we dealt with it, you deal with it. And I like this mentality that's coming up now from the next generation where it's like, we're not going to take it. And even if they fail, and I hope they don't, but they did what they could, and I really respect them for it.
You know, you say deal with it, suck it up as a mentality that comes from older generations such as ours and generally speaking, in generations before ours. And I, you know, recently I watched a comedian, Bill Burr, and he was talking about...
I love Bill Burr, by the way.
I do, too. He's a great satirist, I think. He's talking about from his generation, the way he was taught, if you want to be a quote unquote real man, strong, you just repress, you push it down, you push it in, you don't let it out, you know, and that's not healthy. That's exactly what you're talking about.
And everybody knows it's not healthy. And yet, you know, it's part of our culture. Let's face it. The rugged individualist, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Total mythology, by the way. Like, that's not really how a lot of great, you know, famous rich people in America got there. But the point is, that's part of the culture. It's woven into the culture. Don't whine. Suck it up. Deal with it. Except, you know, here's the irony. Republicans, all they do is whine and cry about everything. Like, they can't handle anything. I'm serious. Like what did a kid say to me? Butt sore. My daughter said, don't get butt sore. I'm like, you can't say get butt sore to me. That's not appropriate. but I know what she means. Like, everybody is, you know, hurt and offended. And it comes from, again, you know, I'm going to lash out at the right because that's what I do. It comes from the right. I mean, I don't watch Fox News, but it does pop up on my news feed on my phone. They're always whining about something. You know, so there is an element of suck it up, you know, be strong, but it's got to be a sort of moderate message, and it's got to be tempered with a little bit of don't stand for injustice. And if you're hurting, say so. And if you need help, ask for help. There's nothing wrong with that either. And I think this generation coming up, that's their value system is a little different than ours was, you know, or our parents was, I think.
Well, I think so too. It is evolution. I hope that we're seeing in terms of human understanding, and the way to cope with complex problems. But you know, from our area where you and I were born and raised, you know, I still am here, and I'm witnessing the mindset here, and it hasn't evolved too much, I have to say. The level of corruption, the level of clan mentality and crab bucket mentality is strong as ever here. You know, religion, I was reading a bit about what one of the people you wanted to talk about, Max Weber, you know, he believing that religion is a huge influence on bureaucracy and how we function in organizational systems in our society. Mm-hmm. And I think that could be, I mean, he looked at it as a positive, I suppose, the Protestant work ethic and the like. But I think that religious influence and that, you know, looking at everything as a, you know, you do this and you get rewarded. If you don't do this, you're going to get punished, as a negative influence in the way that we view our stead in the world and how to function effectively and such. What do you think?
Well, that's a lot of stuff to put on the table. I mean, if you're talking about Weber, I prefer the German pronunciation. I try to always improve my German. Max Weber, but we can call him Weber because I think that's what they say in American schools. And I feel like, you know, if you're talking about Weber, you have to talk about Marx. And there was one other philosopher, sociologist in the Dürrenmatt, maybe. I can't remember. They were the three big ones who talked about, I think their motivation was the advent of full on industrial capitalism. I think that economic phenomenon and social phenomenon is what they were, you know, what really influenced them, right? I mean, Marx wrote Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto kind of as a reaction to what he saw as the ills of capitalism. In my opinion, you can't really fully understand capitalism and its inherent flaws if you don't read Marx and you don't read Max Weber. I think it's really important. Weber, I don't think Weber was an advocate for the bureaucracy and for capitalism. I think Weber was simply saying, you know, how did this happen? And again, I hope I don't misquote him, but my understanding of Weber is that what he said was, you needed the Protestant work ethic before you could have the full onset of full-on capitalism, like we saw in Western Europe and North America. So I think what Weber was saying was, you had to change your thinking before you could succeed as a capitalist.
To be efficient.
Yes, enough. Yes, exactly. The efficiency of bureaucracy, for example, where and the meritocracy. Now, there's a lot about what Weber observed and commented on that we consider positive. For example, the meritocracy. Like, if you do a good job in your position, you get promoted because you've shown. In other words, you're not the nephew of the prince. Like, the nephew of the prince got a great job, but the nephew of the prince was an inept idiot, but he was the nephew of the prince. You know, you're Don Jr. or Eric Trump George W. Bush or George W. Bush. You're kind of an idiot, but you have the right last name and you're born into the right family and you advance. That's the antithesis of Weber.
That again goes back to what I was saying about where you and I were born and raised here. Northeastern Pennsylvania has a lot of that, you know, mentality, and we suffer because of it. We suffer because it is not about merit. And you know, you look at studies across the globe, across the nation, of happiness and what, you know, when people are usually unhappy, it's because they sense that where they live is not a just place. You know, besides having their basic needs met or not having their basic needs met in a physical sense, metaphysically, if they are sensing that it's not about merit, it's not about how good you are, it's not about honesty and integrity, it's about who you know, it's random even to a certain extent, they are depressed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, when you look at the happiness quotient, some of the happiest places in the world are the places where there is the least amount of corruption. So, you know, again, Scandinavian countries, people are highly, you know, the satisfaction level is very high because they perceive that the institutions are working for them and working as efficiently as possible, and that the officials that they put into place know how to do their job and are doing it fairly and properly. And so they just feel better. They just have a sense of well-being that people who live in areas and countries of high corruption don't have.
Right.
And that's I think that's been borne out with a lot of different kinds of research.
Well, and going back to Weber and religion and all of that we talked about, see, what happens often, in my estimation, is people who have deep faith in a God via a religion, you know, like some form of Christianity, in particular, I know that I've experienced that the most. They are often banking on that justice to be borne out by that higher power. You know, they'll facilitate it, and when it doesn't happen, there's such a crisis, or they have to just disconnect and not engage and look at why this thing isn't happening in a fair manner in their community, and they just kiss it up to that higher power. In either case, it's not healthy. You're not going to solve the problems. You're not going to seek justice because you're just kind of you're disconnecting yourself as a responsible individual and giving it to this perceived higher power. How do we get past that, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
If only I could provide the answers for that. Oh, I would be rich and famous. Well, there's a couple things there. I mean, it sounds like you're talking about the corruption that exists at, for example, like the level of a local government. Right? Is that what you're talking about? Is that part of what you're talking about?
Yes, and how people are often suckered into it, or they're passive until a major decision has been borne out and they see, wow, that is so wrong. And how did this happen? Well, you weren't paying attention. That would be my response. You're not doing what you need to do. You're not fighting back because they believe, well, the higher power that I pray to is going to be certain that kind of injustice won't occur. And then when they see it does occur, they're like, what do I do? They're not equipped because they've written off their own sense of responsibility, engagement, expecting this higher power to take care of all that for them.
I feel like it's an abdication of our responsibility as people and citizens and human beings if we simply say it's all in God's hands. That to me is a little bit of a cop out.
No doubt.
Right? So that mentality is sort of antithetical to what I admire. And what I admire is people who you know, the scientific method, empiricism, observing, compiling facts about something and then drawing a conclusion and not simply saying it's in God's hands. Look, here's what I say about that. If you're talking about like people's religiosity, I say it's a lot more frightening to me. The concept of a God, I actually had this discussion with a colleague this summer. The concept of a God existing and looking over the world is infinitely more frightening to me and terrifying than the concept of no God and complete cosmic randomness. Because the idea of the being, the all-powerful being, that lets us suffer the way we suffer in such profound ways, that's frightening to me, right? Isn't that a really sick, twisted being?
Yes.
That would allow that much pain and suffering?
Yes.
And hurt us in that way when that being possesses the power to take that all away. So to me, if you believe in God, that's much more frightening. That God that you believe in is much scarier than just random chance. There's no God. We're just here by chance. Do your best. Good luck. That's not as scary as a God. A God frightens the crap out of me.
Yeah. And I think that works for a lot of the upper set and keeping us again sort of lobotomized and prostrate.
And one of the characteristics of religion is your job is not to think about it and question it. Your job is to believe it. So the church is antithetical to, and I'm sorry, but the mosque and the synagogue are antithetical to that empirical process, the questioning process. They don't encourage that.
No.
They still have their set beliefs and they say, you must believe these things. So to me, if that's the route you've chosen, then you and I view the world in completely different ways, because I'm not willing to say, oh, it's written down in a book somewhere. Okay, then that must be true. No, I want proof. That's just how I am.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
And that desire for proof, that desire to make you prove your idea. Now listen, if you have a belief, you can believe anything you want. You don't have to prove a belief. But if you're going to say to me, oh no, absolutely there's a God, then I'm going to say to you, prove it. It's very simple. And that very concept of asking for proof is what our culture is founded on. And I will tell you that when we talk about the village idiot going to political rallies and spouting out and out lies. And now this isn't me, some lefty liberal, saying he lies. The fact that he lies is very provable. like the facts and the research are there, and he says something that is demonstrably false, and those people listening to him don't engage in the simple process of saying, prove it. Prove what you say is true. They don't want it to be proven or disproven. They just want to believe. And there is no way that we can sit down with them and say, but that's not healthy. If we did that, innocent people would go to jail. If we did that, the very foundations of our society and institutions would fall apart. They don't care about that. They don't care. That's not what their motivation is. And you know what? People like you and me, we probably will never get that. And we'll continue to beat our head against the wall and say, why are you believing this? It's not true. He is lying. We can prove that he's lying. They don't care.
Well,
they don't care.
No. And the thing that makes me most frustrated, besides, you know, that political realm you're talking about, the orangutan 45 and all, and I say that with total disrespect because I disrespect.
There's nothing to respect about about that person. Real quick, I would say to anybody who likes that person, tell me what his positive attributes are.
He's putting conservative justice on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, you know what? They would have a point. And this is where I tell all my lefty friends, elections matter. When they say, I'm not voting for Hillary, blah, blah, blah. I say, well, now guess what? Now that Hillary's not in the White House, look who's sitting on the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh? Let me just say this. Here's what Republicans have given us. They've given us Clarence Thomas, a pathetic joke. They gave us Antonin Scalia, a mean, nasty SOB. They gave us Neil Gorsuch. They gave us Brett Kavanaugh, a sniveling little prep boy who back in our day, we would have flipped out over. We would have said, don't behave that way. That's not right. Don't treat people that way. Don't behave that way. It wasn't cool to be abusive towards women. It wasn't cool to pick on the puniest kid in your gang and make them feel like crap. It wasn't cool. And you know what? We're in his generation. We didn't do that. We were decent human beings even when we were 17 years old. We weren't bullies and we weren't jerks. And what does that say about him as a person? Did he change? I don't think he has.
No. So I got you going off on the Republicans. I like that. What Republicans have given us. That's beautiful. But going back to how we are affected negatively by these mindsets that are sort of narrow and manipulated via fear and sort of playing to the LCD. If not, you know, it's us against them. It really is something we have to transcend, of course, and we can go back and look at some history, perhaps, to learn some lessons, and maybe even some good lessons, not just from their mistakes. Someone like Caesar Augustus, right, the first Roman emperor.
Yeah,
There's some positives from that guy, aren't there, that we can learn from?
Absolutely, and I will tell you, the more I teach Roman history. Latin grammar every day is a, you know, you talk about imposter syndrome. I teach Latin, and I don't know how, you know, people call me a Latin teacher, but somehow I do it. And somehow I kind of know what I'm doing. I fumble my way through it. But getting back to Caesar Augustus and Roman history for a minute, the Roman people, before he came to power, which was in about 32 BC, roughly between 32 and 28, before he came to absolute power, they had known civil war for basically over 100 years. Now think about that for a minute. Our civil war lasted 4.5 years, and it still scars our nation. They were dealing with civil war for roughly 100 years, and it destabilized their entire society. So after that long of fighting wars, you know, think of Afghanistan, think of Sudan, you know, think of areas in the world, think of Syria, think of areas in the world that are racked with war. It's impossible to establish a sort of stable society and foundation within which people can prosper and flourish and feel secure. So 100 years of civil war, and then he comes to power. And he says to the people, no more civil war. Now we're going to build more roads. Now we're going to set up a system of finance so that you can run your business. Now we're going to get people onto farms and we're going to get people working again. Now, it wasn't all peaches and cream. There was slavery. There were land confiscations. There was all kinds of stuff. But overall, you had the advent of the Pax Romana. And what that meant was your average shopkeeper could get up in the morning, eat breakfast with his family, walk to his shop, open his shop, run his business all day, make a little money, and walk home at the end of the night without being killed. And that was a really, really big deal. And that's all Augustus had to deliver. And he did, for the most part. And, you know, they called it the golden, it was the golden age. It was Pax Romana. It was, you could travel roads from the Middle East all the way to England and feel relatively safe and secure because Roman law prevailed. There was a lot of oppression. There was a lot of brutality. There was a lot of exploitation. But for a lot of people, it worked. And that's all he had to deliver because of the instability. Now, fast forward to our current political situation. You have a political clique right now that thrives on instability and disinformation and confusion and an onslaught of lies. And what that does is that makes us really, really numb. And it allows them to manipulate us to the point where if Trump utters a coherent sentence, I feel a little bit better. Like that's all he has to do to make me feel a little bit better. If he says something that sounds reasonable coming out of the mouth of a president, I feel like, oh, thank goodness. Oh, thank goodness. In other words, I've lowered the bar so low that they don't have to deliver much for me to say, oh, thank God. Thank God we're not breaking out in the Civil War. Thank God we're not starting World War III. That's what that destabilization does, and that's how it conditions us to put up with this nonsense that we're putting up with.
Right, and so it's counter to, in a certain sense, what Augustus tried to do. Again, he was brutal in many ways, but
yes.
But when he said we're going to build our society through grand works projects, I guess you could say, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
We can learn a little bit from that. Maybe we, but what you're saying is our present leadership does not want that sort of coherent focus. They want it to be all disoriented because they got nothing to give. All they want to do is maintain their power by dividing us and by confusing us and by instilling fear in us and keeping us, you know, ignorant.
Again, it's the classic destabilization. If the more they destabilize, the more they're able to take advantage of that situation. I mean, I don't see how anybody in their right mind could feel that Trump is a patriotic American who simply loves his country. There's no evidence of that. Show me the evidence of that. Well, he's dodged his taxes for years. I mean, the very first basic thing that anybody can do as a decent citizen is pay their taxes. Right. He doesn't even do that.
No.
So, I mean, I don't see how you could consider him some great patriotic American who loves his country and truly has the best interests of the nation at heart.
I don't think many people really look at him that way. I think many people look at him, again, as a means to an end. He's protecting them in some way, protecting their power or protecting them from the other. That's what he is to people. I don't think most people really think he's a patriot or they even respect him. But anyway, we're running out of time for this go round. It's always a very vivacious, intense, passionate conversation with Seraph William on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. So how are we going to fix all this? We need a visionary of some sort, right? We need an uprising in some way. How are we going to do it? Are you going to lead it? Seraph William?
Okay, no, two things. You said one thing at the end of your last statement. You talked about helping people hold on to power. What I like to think what we're seeing are the convulsions of the body as it's in its death throes. And you've got those last gasping breaths and the flailing around of the limbs. And I like to think that that's the white oligarchy, the white old oligarchy, understanding that its days are limited and that it's doing whatever it can, including Donald Trump, to stay in power. And that, I think, is to be expected from a clique that has held power for so long. When they start to see the actual possibility that they might lose that power, they're pretty much going to do anything. So maybe that's what we're seeing now. In terms of your question about an uprising, I fully support the millennials now who are rising up and demonstrating and saying enough is enough. We're seeing change. All the scientists I hear say that the situation for us now is very dire, but they also add that it is not the end. If we take drastic action, we can help to rectify the situation. Now, that might be Pollyanna-ish. I don't know.
Climate change, I guess you're talking.
Yeah, I'm simply saying that when it comes to global warming, all of the scientists say, here is where we are. Here is where we're probably going to be unless we change. And if we change, there are a number of outcomes we could be looking at that are way more favorable. So,
Greta.
Right? So look, I have no choice. You have a choice in life. You can be optimistic or you can be pessimistic. That's the choice. If you choose to be pessimistic, you got to ask yourself, what are the returns? What do I get back from that? And I choose to be optimistic simply because the returns are greater. Even if I'm wrong, I choose to be optimistic because it allows me to get through my day and it allows me to live my life. And what else can I really do?
Beautiful. Surf William, it's always a distinct pleasure for us to have you on the program. Have a wonderful autumn, and we'll be talking to you again soon before the holidays, I hope, or during the holidays.
Well, because I suffer from imposter syndrome, I can't believe anybody wants to listen to me, but okay.
They do. They love you.
Okay. Peace and love, my brother.
Ciao, brother.
I kept the movie rolling. Pauline Kael, the movie critic for the New Yorker magazine from 1968 to 1991, died 18 years ago on September 3rd, 2001. She was known for her witty, enthusiastic, sometimes caustic, sometimes fawning, but always intensely readable reviews. And she was lucky enough to write about cinema during one of its golden ages, the late 60s, early 70s. She is the subject of a documentary, What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael, which is due to be released at the end of the year. Here is an excerpt from her review of The Godfather Part II, originally published on December 23rd, 1974. At the close of The Godfather, Michael Corleone has consolidated his power by a series of murders and has earned the crown his dead father, Don Vito, handed him. In the last shot, Michael, his eyes clouded, assures his wife, Kay, that he is not responsible for the murder of his sister's husband. The door closes Kay out while he receives the homage of subordinates. And if she doesn't know that he lied, it can only be because she doesn't want to. The Godfather Part II begins where the first film ended. Before the titles, there is a view behind that door. The new king stands in the dark, his face lusterless and dispassionate as his hand is being kissed. The familiar Godfather waltz theme is heard in an ambiguous, melancholy tone. Is it our imagination, or is Michael's face starting to rot? The dramatic charge of that moment is Shakespearean. The waltz is faintly, chillingly ominous. By a single image, Francis Ford Coppola has plunged us back into the sensuality and terror of the first film. And with the relentlessness of a master, he goes farther and farther. The daring of Part II is that it enlarges the scope and deepens the meaning of the first film. The Godfather was the greatest gangster picture ever made, and had metaphorical overtones that took it far beyond the gangster genre. In Part II, the wider themes are no longer merely implied. The second film shows the consequences of the actions in the first. It's all one movie, in two great big pieces, and it comes together in your head while you watch. Coppola might have almost have a pact with the audience. We're already so engrossed in the Corleones that now he can go on to give us a more interior view of the characters at the same time that he shows their spreading social influence. The completed work is an epic about the seeds of destruction that the immigrants brought to the new land, with Sicilians, WASPs, and Jews separate socially but joined together in crime and political bribery. This is the bicentennial picture that doesn't insult the intelligence. It's an epic vision of the corruption of America. Coppola's approach is open-handed. He doesn't force the situations. He puts the material up there, and we read the screen for ourselves. One never wants less of the characters. One always wants more, particularly of Vito in the 1917 period, which is recreated in a way that makes movies once again seem a miraculous medium. This film wouldn't have been made if the first hadn't been a hit, and the first was made because the Paramount executives expected it to be an ordinary gangster shoot-'em-up. When you see the new picture, you wonder how Coppola won the fights. Maybe the answer is that they knew they couldn't make it without him. After you see it, you feel they can't make any picture without him. He directs with supreme competence. Coppola is the inheritor of the traditions of the novel, the theater, and, especially, opera and movies. The sensibility at work in this film is that of a major artist. We're not used to it. How many screen artists get the chance to work in the epic form, and who has been able to seize the power to compose a modern American epic? And who else, when he got the chance and the power, would have proceeded with the absolute conviction that he'd make the film the way it should be made? In movies, that's the inner voice of the authentic hero.
form, picture on a closed circuit. Boy, you lost it all, thinking you could rework it. Stole a credit card and ran away. Back in Louisville, they call the play, and now we'll all rewind and just listen for the lies of summer. We'll all rewind and just listen for the lies of summer. Who gets hurt the most? The guys that you would call a brother. Girls that loved a ghost that had a sick mother. Now you're waiting for the mess to take, but it takes a miracle to heal this break. And now we'll all rewind and just listen for the lies of summer. We'll all rewind and just listen for the lies. Summer. If the doctor would just send his pants, I'd put my hand up on the plexiglass, scan your face, see if you're in there. Wait a sec, I gotta write this down, 'cause once it puts you in a paper gown, you leave no trace. Never been there. So we'll all rewind and just listen for the lies of summer. We'll all rewind and just listen for the lies of summer. We'll all rewind and wait to.
Bush. As the musk of pollen and incredible designs weaved by spiders create the endless possibilities of depth and wondrous interactive existence on the deck built off the house I call home, I bask in the sun as it peers through a bush, breathing it all in.
One more time.
And there you have it, episode 336 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, our good friend and resident philosopher, Surf William. I also would like to thank our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, and writer-reviewer Pauline Kael, and these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Brendan Benson, Nathaniel Frey, James Womack, Russ Brown, Albert Linville, Soundgarden, Amy Mann, Mosean Worker, of course, Terrence Blanchard and Branford Marsalis too. Until next week, why don't we give it a go and try to enjoy this one? Thanks so much for listening.
We've got hope!